"What happens if you lose?" asked Westinghouse. "If they do use my equipment to build this electrical chair, how can we possibly compete under those circumstances?" "We can't. So what do we do?" Paul looked out at the clean, white expanse. A city was just coming into view along the horizon. "We hope that for the next few years no one in New York commits any murders." "Or," added Westinghouse ruefully, "at least that they don't get caught." Typically, Paul's trips to Pittsburgh were brief. 10 hours in transit for a meeting with his client, then an overnight trip back. But this time, Westinghouse asked if he'd like to stay the night. They were having friends for dinner on the following evening, and Marguerite had wondered why Paul never came by the house anymore. She'd invited him to attend if he was free. The guest apartments were all made up. Dinner was for only 11 this time. The salad dressing had a familiar taste. The other guests were not scientists, but rather Pittsburgh gentry. Paul found himself seated next to a young woman who'd clearly mastered all there was to learn at Western Pennsylvania's finest finishing schools. She was well-versed in discussing her favorite breeds of dog, charity work, and the fashions of the day. Paul did not give himself much credit for not making a fool of himself this time on an impolitic subject. It wasn't hard. No impolitic subjects were brought up. It was a well-socialized crowd. Paul recalled his last aborted dinner at the Westinghouse estate, and Tesla's sudden exit before it began. He still hadn't told Westinghouse that Tesla was alive. The deceit gave a bitter taste to his strawberry galette. He was glad there was Bordeaux to absolve his well-intentioned sins. "You didn't like Stephanie much," observed Marguerite as Paul joined her in the kitchen after dinner. All the other guests had retired to the billiard room. "Pardon?" "Paul," said Marguerite, "you're not stupid. That's why George likes you. And that's why we wanted you to make Stephanie's acquaintance." Paul was so flattered to have been described as being liked by George Westinghouse that it took him far too long to realize that Stephanie was the name of the politely effervescent iron heiress sitting beside him at dinner. "Oh," said Paul. "I didn't realize..." Marguerite gave a disappointed sigh as she poured sweet dessert wines for the guests. "It's only that you're a very eligible young man. You know that. And you're not that young, are you?" "I'm 27. Marguerite smiled, as if to say this was not quite as young as he might like to believe it was. "And I have my eye on someone," he explained. He'd never said it out loud before. Having formed the words from mere air, he felt instantly embarrassed. "Oh," said Marguerite, clearly encouraged. "Might I have made her acquaintance?" "I don't think so." Paul was clearly not going to provide her with a name, and she was far too clever to ask. She lifted a tray on which were balanced 11 glasses of Vouvray. "Well," she said as she led Paul out of the kitchen, "if you don't want to tell me who it is, I hope at least that you're not so mum to the young lady in question." Chapter 41. The Mystery of the Filaments. If you really look closely, most overnight successes took a long time. Steve Jobs. The War of the Currents, as the press had begun to call it, had opened along so many simultaneous fronts that Paul was having trouble keeping them straight. It was difficult to remember which battles were even winnable, and which were simply on their way to being lost as slowly as possible. First, there was Edison v. Westinghouse itself, the main event, and the 312 assorted lawsuits that came with it. If Paul's associates were successful in their quest to prove that Edison had lied on his patent application, every single one of these suits would be moot. But until then, they were unenviable drudgery. Edison's plan to bury Paul underneath a mausoleum of paperwork had been a savvy one. Even though Westinghouse's adoption of alternating current gave him a clear advantage in the majority of these suits, Carter, Hughes, and Cravat had to compose 312 sets of briefs, attend 312 sets of court appearances, prepare 312 motions to continue, that is, requests to delay the trial. Thankfully for Paul, Carter and Hughes had taken the lead here after Paul's hospitalization. He'd been bitter about their insistence on doing so at the time, but now it allowed Paul to focus on other fronts. The second of which was Paul's argument before the New York State Legislature that electricity should not be used in executions. These arguments were to be made in person to members of the state legislature in Albany. Paul journeyed there to dine with different state senators. They all appreciated the steaks to which he treated them, the cigars he shared, the offers of similar hospitality on their next visits to Manhattan. Whether he'd won their votes or not, that was a different matter. Edison's pocketbook had done more to ensure a friendly governmental environment than might 100 of Paul's filet mignon. While the two sides fought both in court and in the realm of public opinion, the electrification of America continued. Edison sold DC units to the mansions of Boston, Chicago, and Detroit, while Westinghouse sold AC systems to Telluride, Colorado, and Redlands, California. In New York, Tesla was remembering more and more. Paul would sit up late at the inventor's bedside, watching him scribble his way through notebook after notebook. It seemed that the inner workings of what he'd designed for Westinghouse, for Edison, and on his own, were returning to his command. Paul was encouraged to hear him curse both Westinghouse and Edison at the mention of their names. He had no idea if the inventor's scribbles would ever comprise a new and non-infringing light bulb, but if they did, that would constitute by far the best path to victory. It was on such a visit that Paul had an opportunity to speak to Fanny. There was a proposal he'd been building up the nerve to make ever since his conversation with Marguerite Westinghouse. The chance presented itself on a Saturday night in early February. Agnes had gone out with her castmates after the show, which meant that Paul found a moment alone with her mother. Despite the hour, she made them tea. Paul felt this was a peace offering. Their press gambit against W.H. Foster had gone well. The Huntingtons hadn't heard from him since Agnes's interview had run in the Times. Paul found himself in Fanny's good graces, at least for the moment. "I must thank you, Mrs. Huntington," he said. "I know what you've done for me, and for Mr. Tesla, these past months." She inspected some fading flowers on the table between them. "Your help with my daughter's situation has been appreciated," she said. "We've had a mutually beneficial partnership." She rearranged her flowers by dim candlelight. Paul waited awkwardly for a few moments. "Mrs. Huntington, there is another humble request I'd like to make of you."
"I can see that," she said.
She was, once again, no fool. "I was hoping to take Agnes on a walk. Perhaps this Sunday. The gardens, I'd thought. Prospect Park out in Brooklyn. They've actually got some winter orchids that are still in season. Lovely, quite lovely. Before I asked her, I wanted to have your blessing." Despite Agnes's rather modern disposition, he had decided that in courting her, he should pursue a distinctly old-fashioned path. She was very much a new woman, as they called them in the papers. Having seen the champagne-doused society company in which Agnes secretly traveled, Paul had decided to distinguish himself by way of a formal courtship. A walk through the gardens had been selected to appeal to both of the ladies Huntington. Fanny Huntington looked at him as if she were, for the first time, picturing the aquatic life of a distant planet.
"Mr. Cravat," said Fanny slowly, "I believe Agnes already has plans on Sunday afternoon." Paul didn't get it at first. Well, perhaps next week then. With Henry LaBar Jane. Oh, said Paul. Of the Philadelphia Janes, Fanny added unnecessarily. Yes. It's not their first afternoon outing together. No, no, of course not. Paul wanted to flee. Of course Agnes Huntington would be courted by American royalty. How foolish had he been to think that of all the offers she must receive, she would favor his. That she hadn't mentioned any gentleman callers to Paul only accentuated the extent of his stupidity. She'd been immersed in a social world so far from his that such matters never even occurred to her while in his company. She had not judged Paul wanting. She had found him too insignificant to judge. Henry Jane was the latest in a long line of shipping heirs whose family fortune had recently been extended to real estate. The Janes owned half of Philadelphia and had recently begun snapping up wide swaths of Manhattan as well. Henry Jane, who was only a few years older than Paul, managed his family's foothold in New York. The Quarterlies all agreed that he was the most philanthropically inclined of his siblings and the standard-bearer of the family's fine art holdings to boot. "Are they to marry?" Paul asked. It was only after the words had come out that he realized how impolite they were. It was shame speaking. He wished he'd kept his mouth shut. "Well, I most certainly can't say," snapped Fanny. "But I will say that Mr. Jane is quite an interesting young man. Completed his studies in Leipzig. Speaks 5 languages.
How fascinating. My daughter's company is in high demand, Mr. Cravath. Will she marry Mr. Jane? I'm not sure. Her gifts, not to mention her grace, have afforded my daughter a rare opportunity. It is her intention not to waste it, and it is my earthly duty to make sure she doesn't."
She crossed her arms before her small frame. "Mrs. Huntington," said Paul, "I wish you both the very best. I'm proud to be your and your daughter's attorney. It is a position I cherish and one that I hope to maintain for a very long time." This emphasis on Paul's position seemed to satisfy Fanny. Her goodbye was peaceable. Paul found his way to the front door as quickly as he could. He'd made an ass of himself. But he gave a start as he opened the door. Agnes stood on the stoop, fishing in her handbag for her key.
"Cravath,"
she said with a smile, pleased by the magic of the opening door.
"Perfect timing as always."
Agnes looked a little tipsy. She was in good spirits, clearly happy from her night out. Had she been with castmates? Or with Mr. Jane? He realized how little he knew of her activities when they were apart. He couldn't imagine being in Tesla's room with her ever again. He moved aside so that she could come in from the cold.
"Will you join me for a nightcap?" she asked.
"You will never believe the night I've had. Did you know that swans bite?
They bite hard. It's horrible. You'll love this story."
But Paul did not remove his hand from the door. "I'm sorry, Miss Huntington," he said. "I must be off. Good evening." Before she could remove her coat and place it on the brass rack, Paul had already walked out and shut the door behind him. He descended the steps quickly, walking determinedly into the night. He did not look back to see if her face was in the window. Instead, he kept his eyes on the black leather of his shoes. He wished for sleep to come quickly, for his dreams to pass unremembered, and for the dawn to greet him soon. He needed to get back to work. Paul's 4 associate attorneys were waiting for him when he entered their ramshackle offices on Greenwich Street the next morning. It was time for their weekly appointment. They appeared to have slept there the night before. The men's shirt collars were loosened, their ties undone. The single room smelled of sweat and dried coffee. For once, he envied them. With flair, one of them handed Paul a folder full of papers. "Why don't you summarize it for me, Mr. Beyer?" asked Paul as he opened the folder. The associate exchanged a look with his fellows. "What?" said Paul. "It's only, well, I'm Bynes." Paul looked up. He could have sworn that Beyer was the one with the mustache. "Apologies. What do you have to show me?" asked Paul. "Well, sir," said whichever one of them it was, "I think we've got him." The associate gestured to the top document within the folder. "That is an interview with Thomas Edison in the New York Sun from October 20th, 1878. In it, he clearly states that his new electrical lamp consists of a glass bulb hollowed out into a vacuum with a platinum filament inside. The filament is the part that glows." "I know what a filament is," said Paul. "Well, Edison's patent, granted January 27th, 1880, refers to a glass bulb hollowed out into a vacuum with a cotton filament inside. He changed the filament." Paul realized what this meant. He told the press he was using one kind of filament, but by the time he filed for the patent, he was already using a different kind. He hadn't gotten the lamp to work as early as he'd claimed. "Yes," said the boy. "But," added one of the associates who Paul was certain was neither Beyer nor Bynes, "that's not even the best part. All that proves is that Edison lied to the press." "Which is not a crime," said the one with the mustache. "Right," said the fourth of the associates. "So then what if we can show that Edison lied on the patent itself?" "That would be something, Mr.—" "I'm Beyer," said the boy. Paul had a hard time believing that to be the case, but it could not have mattered to him less. Beyer continued, "The bulbs that have been coming out of Edison General Electric plants use bamboo filaments." He showed Paul a sketch of the device in question. There was no mistaking the material that composed the filament, even to a layman's eyes. "First, he told the press it was platinum," said Paul. "Then he told the patent office it was cotton, but it's actually bamboo." "Yes." He was just making things up. He didn't actually get the bulb working with bamboo till after the patent was granted. This was the moment Paul had been waiting for. The four associates tried to hide their proud smiles behind professionally blank expressions. They'd done well, and they knew it. But they seemed to feel that convincing Paul of their competence required masking their youthful exuberance. Watching these boys pretend to be older than they were made Paul feel even older himself. "What will you do now?" asked the mustached associate, who was probably Bynes. Paul did not try to hide his smile. "I think it's time that we took the deposition of Mr. Thomas Edison." Chapter 42. The Deposition of Thomas Edison. Everybody steals in science and industry. I've stolen a lot myself. But I know how to steal. They don't know how to steal. Thomas Edison. For over a year, the name Edison had haunted Paul's days. He had met Thomas Edison only once, and yet the inventor was ever present in his thoughts. His daily life was a groove in the invisible orbit around Edison's solar mass. Practically every slip of paper that crossed Paul's desk bore Edison's name. Edison's presence dominated the work of Paul's waking hours and often his sleeping ones. He had spent many times more hours dreaming of Edison than speaking to him. Paul arrived early for the deposition. At barely 7 in the morning, he entered Grosvenor Lowry's Broad Street law offices. The wallpapered rooms crackled with activity. Assistants, apprentices, secretaries, and errand boys flitted about in preparation, bursting with energy. As Paul waited, The whole office primped itself for the great man's arrival. The brass was polished with vinegar, the wood rubbed with alcohol and wax, and every stray paper was tucked into a drawer or filing cabinet. When Edison finally arrived, late, Paul was instantly struck by the change in his appearance. He'd aged in the past year. His hair had gone almost completely gray. He'd grown plumper around the middle. His clothes had been applied haphazardly. He was, in short, a human being. And that seemed strangest of all. The devil himself could barely knot his own bow tie. Edison sat at the long table as if this deposition was but one of the many chores to which he would be forced to attend that morning. No doubt it was. He whispered a few words to Lowry, his attorney, who took the seat to his left. To Edison's right sat the court secretary, here to transcribe his every word. "All right," said Edison. "Let's get this over with." "Good morning," said Paul, fastidiously laying out his papers on the table. "And you are?" Paul stopped. Edison smiled. The inventor was taunting him, trying to rattle him before the questioning had even begun. Edison's act was terribly good. He would feign a discombobulated indifference to these worldly affairs before lashing out at just the right moment. "I am Paul Cravath, attorney for Mr. George Westinghouse," the court secretary dutifully typed as the men spoke. "Grosvenor Lowry, attorney for Mr. Thomas Edison."
"And I am Thomas Alva Edison."
"Please state your place of birth for the record," said the court secretary.
"Ohio. But I grew up in Port Huron, Michigan."
"And the place where you currently reside?"
"I have an estate in West Orange, New Jersey. I have my offices at 65 Fifth Avenue, New York City."
The secretary nodded. "It is March 11th, 1889, she informed the room. "Mr. Cravath, you may begin." Paul had been practicing his questions for days. "What was the first thing you invented, Mr. Edison?" Edison laughed. "It was, well, it's called an automatic repeater." "And when was this?" "Is George Westinghouse planning on claiming that he invented that now, too?" "What year was it?"
1865. I'd been a butcher boy before that, selling candy on the rails. Left home with a single bag to my name. Rode the line for a few years. I learned the trains well, found odd jobs here and there, things that needed fixing, repairing. I've always had a way with machines."
"So it would appear."
"I became friendly with the Western Union men at the stations. Now they had some fun devices, didn't they? I started to do what it is that I've always done. I tinkered. I asked a lot of questions. Some the men could answer, some they could not. If not, then I was required to develop my own answers. There were things they would discuss. I would overhear their conversations. If only we could loop messages automatically, if only we had a device to relay the signals. But then they wouldn't do a thing about it. They would just move along, drown their complaints in their beer. So I did what it is that I have done ever since. I recognized a problem, and then I set about solving it. There was use for a small machine that might automatically relay telegraph messages. Fantastic. I spent a few months fiddling until I'd built one that worked.
And then," said Paul,
"you sold the design to Gold and Stock for $200. You know this story.
You've recited it many times to the press.
It's a good story."
"It's a very simple one," said Paul.
"But your tales of invention always are, aren't they? This is what your kind," and let the record reflect that by your I am referring to Mr. Cravath, and by kind, I am referring to idiots, "can never wrap your brains around. It genuinely is simple. I identify the gap in existing technology, and then I plug it. With these hands right here."
"Oh, I just realized. You were trying to get a rise out of me, weren't you?"
If Mr. Cravath is being argumentative, offered Lowry, I can instruct the court.
No, no, Grosvenor, said Edison. Mr. Cravath and I are just having a bit of fun with each other, aren't we?
Paul agreed, silently. He had expected some sparring. He would have been disappointed without it.
This process you've described, said Paul, you're plugging. You've applied it ever since?
After the repeater, Western Union made me a deal. I invented a number of things for them, and then I came to New York where I opened up my own shop, a place to tinker.
You were a teenage vagabond, riding the rails, and by 22 you'd made it to New York.
And by 30 I was a millionaire.
People seemed to find some value in my tinkerings, it would seem, from the telegraph to the telephone to the phonograph to the light bulb. They were all problems out for the solving. I did so and have, no thanks to your efforts, been comfortably compensated for it.
You invented the telephone? Asked Paul.
Yes.
Funny. I thought Alexander Graham Bell did that.
It's a lie, said Edison. But so far, the courts have failed to recognize the truth of what happened. I invented the telephone, not him. I had the idea. I crafted the device. He just got his application to the patent office before I did.
Whoever files first holds the patent, says the lawyer.
To which the inventor at this table says, why? Why should it be so? It wasn't always.
That's true. The courts have not always held that the first to file gets the patent, but they do now.
Men like you have reduced my profession to a game of paperwork. It's tedious and it's absurd.
You weren't the first to the telephone, said Paul.
But here you are claiming the invention was yours. What about the light bulb? Much to your chagrin, the courts have steadfastly upheld my claim on that.
We're working on it.
I was the first to the light bulb.
Were you, though?
Surely the problem, as you put it, had been around for decades. 1,000 engineers had tried to create indoor electrical lamps. But only I succeeded.
What about Sawyer and Mann?
What about them?
Their patent on incandescent light, which my client licensed, predates yours by a few years.
I suppose so, said Edison indifferently. But their device wasn't complete. It didn't work. Their patent was quite broad. It was a suggestion of the thing, not the thing itself.
For instance, offered Paul, the Sawyer and Mann patent did not specify a type of filament.
Edison's face lit up. Oh, my. That's very technical coming from you. Yes, the Sawyer and Mann patent suggests, among its vagaries, that there should be some sort of carbonized filament, a thin thread in the center which emits light when it gets hot. But it doesn't go further on that point, or on many others.
And then on your patent claim, you did specify a filament, didn't you?
I most certainly did.
And what was that filament?
Edison gestured to the papers on the table. You must have the claim among that pile of documents before you.
I want you to tell me, for the record.
Paul nodded toward the typist. You will be disappointed then, said Edison. I'm not sure I remember.
Then I'll help. Your application says it was a cotton filament.
All right.
Paul selected one of the papers from his neat piles.
Was it?
Was it what?
Was it a cotton filament that, after decades of trying, finally made the lamp work?
Yes.
Are you sure?
Because you told the New York Herald that it was made of platinum.
As you said earlier, Mr. Cravath, I give many interviews.
Is there cotton in the bulbs that you currently ship to your customers?
What are you getting at?
It isn't bamboo.
Lowry spoke quickly. Don't answer that.
I'm happy to, said Edison.
Don't, insisted Lowry. Edison turned his wrath away from Paul and toward his own attorney.
I said that I'll answer, Grosner. Don't give me that goddamned look.
He turned his attention back to Paul.
It's all three.
All three? Edison shook his head.
You have never understood what it is that I do.
So tell me. Edison leaned forward, resting his elbows on the table.
I create things, Mr. Cravath. Things that did not exist before. Someone like you will never understand what it is to bring something new into the dull world.
Didn't your staff do that?
All the engineers in your lab, the army of technicians who do the actual work of experimentation at EGE.
Yes, said Edison.
That's my point exactly. I hired those engineers. I set them to their task. I defined the scope of their inquiry and then set the method by which they might inquire. For a century, scientists had failed to build an indoor electrical lamp. Until me. How did I do it? That's what you want to hear. It was this. I surveyed all the designs that had been tried before. I saw what had gotten close. I saw what had fallen short of the mark. I found the cracks, and I set my men to paving them. This is what science is, Mr. Cravath. This is what discovery is. It's not a flash of color. It's not a moment of divine inspiration. It is not the hand of God reaching down to press the pointed finger. It's work. It's drudgery. It is trying 10,000 different shapes of bulb, then trying 10,000 different air fillings, then, yes, 10,000 different filaments. It is realizing that those are the three components that matter, and then trying 10,000 times, 10,000 times, 10,000 combinations until one of them works. And then, selling it to a public who never thought such a thing was possible. It is this last part that you are really accusing me of. And of that, I will confess, I am guilty as sin. Yes, Mr. Cravath, I sold the light bulb. Americans did not have them, then they did. Then they bought them by the train load. And is there any part of you that doubts you owe all of that to me? Is there any part of you that believes that without me, Americans would have electrical light inside their homes? Of course not. You want the light, but you don't want to know how I made it. You privilege the effect, but you're horrified that someone had actually to cause it. I invented the goddamned light bulb. I gestated it in the minds of the public. You whine to me about filaments. Platinum, cotton, bamboo? There were 10,000 more. My patent covers all of them. George Westinghouse can twiddle with his idle details. He so loves his details, doesn't he? This precise shape of bulb, this precise angle of wiring. That's all well and good. But knowing the steps is hardly any good if you failed to make it to the dance. I hired the band. I booked the hall. I advertised the show. And you hate me because my name is on the poster. Well, I say this. The light bulb is mine. If the word invention is to maintain even a semblance of rational sense, then it must be said that the light bulb was my idea, it was my invention, and it is my patent. Every bulb, every vacuum, every one of your piddling filaments.
and to the mute ingratitude with which you've repaid me, I will say only one last thing." Edison leaned back in his chair before he loosed his final words. "You're welcome." Chapter 43. Fail, fail, and fail again. Sometimes we stare so long at a door that is closing that we see too late the one that is open. Alexander Graham Bell. It came as little surprise when, 2 months later, a New York federal court ruled against the Westinghouse Electric Company in the central light bulb suit. Paul had been prepared for this defeat since Edison's deposition. The argument Edison had made to Paul was repeated by Lowry in court. It was undeniably effective. Thomas Edison had not patented the perfect light bulb, agreed the judge. He'd patented the field of light bulbs. That he'd later improved on his design, and that Westinghouse had potentially improved on it even further, was beside the point. Westinghouse's bulbs infringed on Edison's patent, even if Edison's exact patent was for a device that didn't work as intended. Paul's strategy had been to narrow the scope of Edison's patent to a non-existent, non-functioning device. In response, Edison had succeeded in broadening the scope of his patent to include practically anything that lit up. In court, Hughes had done almost all the arguing for the Westinghouse side. Carter had supplied the gaps. Paul had barely gotten a word on the record. He wanted to attribute the loss to his partner's stodgy techniques, but he knew, in his heart, that it wasn't their fault. Edison's genius extended not only to science, but apparently to litigation as well. Spring had sprinkled Manhattan with bunchberry, violet, and rosemallow as Paul and his partners drearily descended the steps of the Lower Manhattan courthouse. They would appeal. Paul had already begun to prepare the paperwork. The New York court would not be the end of Edison v. Westinghouse. The Federal Court of Appeals would be next, and if that failed, there were higher courts still, and Paul could only hope to fall from ever taller heights. To further blacken Paul's mood, the light bulb suit was not even the only battle he lost that month. Paul also found himself on the wrong side of the New York State Legislature in Albany. The electrical chair was approved for use by the people's elected representatives. Now Paul would have to take this battle to the courts as well, arguing that this state law was invalid on constitutional grounds. Electrocution, Paul would argue, constituted the very definition of cruel and unusual punishment forbidden by the Constitution. He would have to make this argument quickly because soon enough some New Yorker was bound to be sentenced to death by Westinghouse's alternating current. Paul's failures did not end there. He was soon summoned to the Huntington's sitting room. He could hear Tesla pacing the floor above them. He had barely visited the house since his mortifying conversation with Fanny. His work had given him ample excuses, so his evening visits had grown infrequent and brief. Surely Fanny had told Agnes about their attorney's unfortunate offer. He could not bear to be alone with Agnes for fear that she might bring it up. His best hope was for his infatuation to be forgotten by all involved. No doubt outings with Mr. Henry Jane would be enough to occupy Agnes's attention. Sitting across from Paul, in her typical finery, Agnes wore the same uncracked Mona Lisa look that she wore whenever her mother was present. At one point, Paul had imagined he understood some of what lay behind that smile. Now he was certain that he did not. "Since my daughter's interview," said Fanny, "which you so helpfully arranged, we've heard no more from that vile Mr. Foster. You have, we believe, succeeded. We are quite grateful." Paul looked to Agnes for reaction. He found none. "Thank you," he replied. "It has been my pleasure, I assure you."
I'm sure you'll understand then when I suggest that your friend upstairs should therefore take his leave of this house." Paul had expected this from Fanny eventually. But now?
"Mr. Tesla has nowhere else to go," he said. "If I could depend on your hospitality just a little longer..."
"We cannot have him here any longer. I trust you to understand."
Agnes turned away. This was not her plan, he could tell that much. Nor was it her wish. But she wasn't prepared to go against her mother. Fanny went on.
"The thrust of the matter is that we're having some people for dinner in 4 days' time, Thursday evening. The Jane family."
Paul thought he saw the hint of a smile as she spoke.
"We haven't been able to receive guests since Mr. Tesla took up residence here. I'd ask you to see to it that he's departed by then. I wish it could be helped."
If the parents of Henry LeBar Jane were visiting the Huntingtons' considerably more humble home for dinner, then they were vetting Agnes. Agnes must have done quite well in the courtship thus far, and so the real subject of their visit would be Fanny. She was the one up for judgment. A potential marriage into a family of fortune and stature could not be allowed to be jeopardized by the presence of Nikola Tesla.
"I understand," was all that Paul could say in response.
"We are very sorry about this," said Agnes.
This was the first she'd spoken since Paul had arrived.
"I'm so very sorry."
"I will see that my friend is removed from your hospitality by Thursday," said Paul.
He rose to his feet, buttoning his black jacket in what he hoped appeared to be a gesture of professionalism.
"Your patience has been appreciated, and I hope that I might continue to represent you."
He had started for the doorway when Agnes spoke again.
"Where will you take him?"
Paul had no immediate answer to her question. Could any other corner of New York be safe from Edison's grasp? He could check Tesla into a mountain sanitarium somewhere, except that sanitariums required nurses and groundskeepers and window cleaners. What Paul needed to do was to remove Tesla to a place where money could not reach, a place where Edison's connections would do him no good, a place where the lights still flickered from melting wicks.
"Miss Huntington," said Paul as he arrived upon an unpleasant solution,
"have no fear. Mr. Tesla will be perfectly safe."
"I've another place I can keep him."
Chapter 44 The Prodigal Cravath Returns. I believe it is worthwhile trying to discover more about the world, even if this only teaches us how little we know. It might do us good to remember from time to time that, while differing widely in the various little bits we know, in our infinite ignorance, we are all equal. Karl Popper. Agnes insisted that she accompany Paul and Tesla to Nashville. The forcefulness of her demand came as a surprise, both to Paul and to Fanny. Paul knew that Agnes had come to care greatly for Tesla. He'd spent too many nights with them in the attic room to doubt that. But he had not realized just how much of a fight she would put up to remain alongside him. Paul would not have thought that Agnes could ever convince her mother to acquiesce to the trip, yet somehow she did. Whatever backstage dramas went on in the Huntington house, the two women's negotiations were hidden from him. Whatever Agnes said to her mother was unknown. Whatever Fanny would extract in return was unimaginable. But ultimately, Fanny relented. Dinner with the Janes was postponed for a week, and an understudy given a chance to shine at the Met. All so that Agnes could make certain that Tesla arrived safely in Tennessee. Had Fanny softened her grip? Or had Agnes hardened her rebellion? Perhaps the warm thoughts of a Jane courtship had relaxed Fanny's worry. Perhaps Agnes had grown bolder in her demands for a life outside a polished glass case. The journey to Nashville took two separate railroad lines and a transfer through Cincinnati.
The travelers employed 3 first-class sleeping quarters. Agnes consumed herself with practicalities, seats, meals, tickets, departure times. Tesla was quiet and rarely left the sleeping car. This had been his first journey outside in months, and it clearly overwhelmed him. That first night, Paul heard Agnes sing him to sleep through the wall of the car. He realized that he had only ever heard her sing before at the Players Club. Tesla had evidently become a frequent private audience. As Paul turned his ear to the wall and strained to better hear the sound, he knew that Tesla was a lucky man. Paul spent much of the trip worried about how Agnes would react to Nashville. He imagined that she would recoil from the crevasse's humble 3-story. He couldn't even fathom what she'd make of his father. But during their meals together, she mostly discussed Tesla. The slow process of his recovery, a recent update from her alienist. She left little doubt as to on whose behalf she had undertaken this journey. Paul's offer of a Sunday walk went unmentioned over the 2-day trip. So did the name Henry Jane. She was kind enough not to rub it in Paul's face. He was appreciative. Between the crowd in the dining car and the time spent caring for Tesla, they were rarely alone. He had blessedly little opportunity to further embarrass himself in front of his client. He enjoyed her company so much that he was almost able to forget that this was likely the last time he ever would. It was dawn when a terrific scream of brakes announced the arrival of the Louisville Railroad's train number 5 at the Nashville Depot. The conductors roused yawning passengers from their seats. Paul hopped the single step from the train onto the platform. His eyes took a moment to adjust to the golden Tennessee light. The bloom of a late spring day that was just promising to begin. Behind him, Agnes led Tesla out into the sunshine. She looked bleary-eyed. He was awake, if typically catatonic. As Paul exited the station, he could see a familiar figure standing tall beneath the willows. "My son," said Erastus Cravath, extending his hand. A firm handshake was Erastus's preferred greeting. It always had been. Paul turned to introduce his companions, but his father beat him to the punch. "And you," said Erastus, "must be Miss Huntington." He bowed politely. She returned the gesture with unpretentious grace.
"Your son has told me so much about you, sir. It's an honor to finally meet you."
"Oh, my dear, you mustn't listen to too much of what Paul tells you. He does so like to exaggerate." "Father," interrupted Paul, "this is Nikola Tesla." "My, you're tall. And it's a great pleasure to make your acquaintance as well." He extended a hand, but the inventor merely stared off into the distance. He seemed largely unaware that there were human beings around him, or that one of them, Paul's father, was attempting to say hello. "You are unwell, my friend," he said. "I understand. Let us see if we cannot get you better." He gestured to Big Annie, the family horse that Paul had named in his childhood. She was tied to a post beside the family's carriage, which was older than she was. Paul and his father didn't speak much during the hour-long ride back to the house. Instead, Paul pointed out various sights to his guests. Though Paul had been born in Ohio, the family had moved to Nashville when he was 5. His sister, Bessie, had been born soon thereafter. Bessie was off and married now to a respectable husband in Clarksville. She wrote to him occasionally. He didn't always have the time to respond. Nashville had grown since Paul had last ridden up the Cumberland River. The noisy docks now teemed with young workingmen, a generation of laborers who'd been able to trade farm tools for barrel lifts. Erastus and Ruth Cravath lived in a 3-story farmhouse northwest of the town center. It was quite a hike from the university, but Paul's mother appreciated the separation from her husband's working life.
The crevasse had selected the farmhouse for its spiritual simplicity, not its practical comforts. They had never made any proper attempt at farming. They kept no livestock in the adjacent barns save their few horses for transportation. They grew no crops. With Paul in New York, and Erastus traveling so much to raise funds, there was no one around the house that could be counted upon for field labor. The barren acres surrounding the house stretched to the horizon. The slanted wooden roof had worn since Paul had last laid eyes on it. The whole house seemed to have fallen into a state of comfortable dishabille. Neither Erastus nor Ruth would demand thicker windows or sturdier front steps until one of those parts had completely broken. In Paul's childhood, no one wanted for anything they truly needed, but no one had anything they might merely want. The house was the color of Tennessee dirt. "Hello, Mother," Paul said as he pushed open the squeaky screen door. "I'm home." Chapter 45. All Happy Families. Technology is nothing. What's important is that you have a faith in people, that they're basically good and smart. And if you give them tools, they'll do wonderful things with them. Steve Jobs. It took a long day for Paul and Agnes to explain their rather unique predicament to Erastus and Ruth Cravath. In letters, Paul had described the basic events of the past 18 months. Tesla, Westinghouse, Edison. He'd told them about his difficulties in court and the looming disaster surrounding the electrical chair. None of this information was new. But the fact that Paul and Agnes had conspired to house Tesla in secret, to keep him safe from Edison without even Westinghouse knowing, this was not a fit subject for a letter home. Ruth and the Reverend both took it well. They seemed more concerned for Tesla's safety than anything else. Erastus's faith prized nothing so much as a man in need. Ruth suggested that Tesla might take the bedroom that had belonged to Bessie. It hadn't yet been cleared of her childhood detritus, but Erastus hoped that Tesla wouldn't mind the clutter. "It's a kind thing you're doing," said Agnes to Ruth. Ruth shrugged. "It's a kind thing you've already done." "He might be here for a little while," said Paul. "It would be our pleasure, my son," said Erastus. He turned to Tesla, who sat straight-backed on the sofa. "Would you like me to show you to your room?" Tesla stared straight ahead, his eyes fixed on a point midway up the white wall. The activity of the past days seemed to have caused his recovery to regress.
"The universe wears coats. The universe wears shirts. The universe shall be unbuttoned."
Everyone stared at Tesla for a moment.
"We'll get him well," said Ruth.
Later that night, after his parents had retired to bed, Paul came out onto the back porch to find Agnes sneaking a cigarette. It startled him for a moment to see her there, on the porch of his childhood home. The moon lit her curly hair better than any light bulb ever could.
"Miss Huntington," he whispered.
She looked as if she'd been caught committing a crime.
"Sorry. I know your father hates smoke."
"I won't tell if you won't." He sat next to her on the porch. The old wood creaked under his weight.
"I know how much you've done for Nicola."
"Thank you."
"Ah, well."
She took an inhale.
"It's not as if he has anyone else."
She gazed out at the night sky. She puffed a plume of smoke into the air and watched it disintegrate between the stars. A colony of crickets hummed from the faraway weeds.
"Have you ever met someone so alone?"
she said suddenly. "He's the emperor of his own private kingdom,"
He's its only inhabitant.
Yes.
So that makes him its slave as well.
She seemed reflective, almost philosophical. She'd been that way since they'd arrived. He wasn't sure what had brought about the change in her demeanor. On previous occasions on which Paul had seen Agnes delivered from her mother's peering gaze, she'd been fiery and playful. Now she was wistful. All Paul's worries on the train about how she would take to Nashville had proved unnecessary. She'd made herself very much at home. She'd been friendly with his parents. She'd insisted on helping Ruth make up Tesla's bed. Agnes settled into what had once been Paul's childhood bedroom like a long-lost cousin. She took another puff of her fading cigarette.
Nikola Tesla arrived in Manhattan with what? A few nickels in his pocket? He was homeless. He had no job, no connections, no family or friends to rely on. Do you know what he had?
She gestured to her skull.
His mind. It was his very otherworldliness that made him what he is. He did not become the most famous inventor this side of Thomas Edison by playing the game so well. He did it by refusing to play at all. And as someone who's played awfully well myself, I respect him for it. I'd very much like to live in a world that doesn't see people like him eaten alive.
And Henry LeBar Jane? Asked Paul. Would he agree? He'd never said the name aloud to her before. His voice sounded petulant, even to himself.
You apparently have a lot of opinions about someone you know nothing about. That was mean. It was.
Paul had avoided this conversation for 2 days on the train. He'd avoided it many times in New York, but the intimacy of having Agnes in his parents' house made him feel unable to preserve such polite silence any longer. I've spent my life coming in second place to men with last names like Jane. You'd think I'd be used to it by now.
Second place?
Paul searched her face. Her mother had apparently not told her about his invitation to a Sunday walk among the flowers. Was this a generous act on Fanny's part? It had saved Paul some measure of embarrassment without his knowing. Yet he no longer had anything to lose by honesty.
I asked your mother if I might take you walking, he confessed.
She informed me of the time you spent in the company of Mr. Jane.
That sounds like the kind of thing I'd expect from my mother.
I'm sorry for insulting him, said Paul. It wasn't fair of me.
I'm sorry that my mother embarrassed you,
said Agnes in turn.
She is complicated, as is the situation.
Paul looked at her curiously. He wasn't sure what she meant. She appeared to be in the midst of making a very difficult decision. Paul stayed quiet. If she was going to say something to him, something difficult, he would let her make that decision on her own.
Look, she said at last, there's a lot about all of this. My mother, Henry Jane, that you don't know. And, well, I want to tell you.
All right, said Paul.
But I'm afraid to.
Of all the emotions she'd expressed to him, fear had never been among them. Edison had not frightened her. Nor had Stanford White. Nor had the danger of keeping Tesla in her home. What was scaring her?
You can trust me, said Paul.
If nothing else, I'm your lawyer. She smiled for a moment.
I lied to you.
About what? He watched her struggle to find the words.
Miss Huntington? That's just the thing,
she said at last.
My name isn't Agnes Huntington.
Chapter 46. But